Good morning. You're listening to Radio Maria. It's just gone 10 a.m. on Tuesday, the 16th of April. Right. And you join me, Sarah Sykes, in the Cambridge studio this morning for Just Life, the program where we hear from people of all walks of life, sharing their knowledge and experience from their work, leisure interests and study. Today, our guest is Dr. Ben Outhwaite from Cambridge University Library's Geniza Research Unit. He's returning for his fourth time to tell us more about the manuscript fragments found in a Cairo synagogue at the turn of the last century. So, without further ado, I'll hand you over to Ben. Ben, what are you going to talk to us about today?
Thanks very much, Sarah. I think today I thought that since this is probably the last time that I'll be doing this and I'll try and wrap things up, I think that I will focus today on the relations between Jews and Christians that we see in the Cairo Geniza. It's not a kind of relationship that you would expect to see well attested in the collection, which comes, you know, as you said, from Cairo, from properly speaking, Al-Fustat, the old Muslim capital of Egypt. You would expect, you know, predominantly the material to be about the relations between Jews and the Muslim rulers and the Muslim citizens of the Fatimid and Ayyubid realms. But in fact, in the period that we've been looking at most, which is sort of 10th century, the 11th century, the 12th century, so what we'd say is the High Middle Ages, Egypt was still a majority Christian country. It had a Muslim rulership. In the 11th century, it was Shiite. Before then, it had been Sunni, and it became Sunni again later under the Ayyubids and then the Mamluks. But the great majority of the people who lived in Egypt were in fact Christians, you know, Coptic Christians, you know, Greek Orthodox Christians, you know, various different varieties of Christianity. And there were, of course, huge numbers of monasteries and churches. And in fact, the Fustat Geniza itself, the synagogue from which our collection comes, is in the smallest, most historic part of the city of Cairo, what is today the city of Cairo. And it's a walled area that was there long before Cairo was built, called the Fortress of Babylon. And the synagogue sits within the walls of the old fortress, and it's surrounded on three sides by churches, because this was, you know, a Christian town before the arrival of the Muslims, and continued after the Muslim invasion of Egypt for some centuries to be a predominantly Christian part of town, much as the rest of the country was. It was only really over sort of the 12th century and then into the 13th century that the balance of religion changed in Egypt as more and more Christians and Jews converted to Islam or moved away. And this was, as much for economic and social reasons as it was for, you know, deeply held religious views and beliefs. So I thought that I've picked three manuscripts to talk about today, which talk about the relationship that the two minorities under Islam, the two principal minorities under Islam in Egypt, Judaism and Christianity, the relationship that they had between us. And of those minorities, the Jews were definitely the minority, because there were many, many more Christians than Jews. Even in the most populous Jewish areas of old Cairo, they would have been greatly outnumbered by the Christian population around them. And, you know, as you might expect, it is a complicated relationship. While there was a legal framework imposed by the Muslim rulers of Egypt that's based on, you know, the teachings of the Quran and on Sharia law as to how Muslims treat their non-Muslim minorities, the dhimmi, the other members of the Abrahamic religions, the Christians and Jews, there is no set legal framework within Sharia law for how Christians and Jews should treat each other. And so what we see in the Geniza is how it worked in practice. And because of the nature of the Geniza collection, which is, you know, as anyone who's heard me talking about this before, it's like a vast kind of waste paper bin where people just discarded things that, you know, that they didn't want to throw away properly because they might be holy, they might have the name of God in, they're written in the Hebrew language or in the Hebrew script, and so that itself is holy. You can't just leave it lying around or throw it away. So they discarded it into this cupboard, this big storeroom, and it's all manner of material. And, it, you know, it's personal letters, legal documents, things like that. And it gives us a very detailed but incomplete picture of the relationship the Jews had with the Christians around them in Egypt, but also just on occasion, because of these rare survivals that come from far away, we also have documents that relate to Jews and Christians in entirely different parts of the world. And so I was thinking that, you know, because we've just had Easter and Passover is coming up, that this was a good time really to look at this relationship between Jews and Christians. The festivals of Passover and Easter are closely historically and religiously connected. And they also feature in the first document that I'm going to talk about. But I think, Sarah, first we might have some music.
Yes, I will put the first song on. This is Exodus 15, Song of Miriam by the Geo Choral Subscription. That was the Song of Miriam by the Geo Choral Subscription. And you're here with us listening to Just Life. And we have in the studio Dr. Ben Althwaite from the Ganesa Research Unit at Cambridge University. And he is talking to us about medieval manuscripts from the Cairo Ganesa. We're just about to hear more about Christian-Jewish relationships from him. Over to you, Ben.
Thanks, Sarah. So before the music, I was just talking about Easter and Passover. Because of the way that the Jewish and Christian calendars are calculated, Easter and Passover sometimes come together basically at the same point in the year, and other times they're quite far apart. This year's an example of that, in that Easter was, what, a couple of weeks ago, and Passover starts on the 15th of Nisan in the Jewish calendar, which is, I think, Monday next week. And being Judaism, where the practice is to go from the evening to the evening of the following day, it starts on the Monday evening, sort of when the sun sets. And it will end about a week later in the evening, 8 days later. If you think in medieval times, and particularly in somewhere like the Fortress of Babylon, old Fustat, the, you know, heart of old Cairo, on at a time when the two calendars coincided, you would get, you know, Jews coming out of the synagogue, you know, after celebrating various services for the pilgrim festivals, and the festivals like Passover, and they would be bumping into Christians who were, you know, also similarly celebrating their festivals in the churches all around them. And what we don't find in the Cairo Ganesa, and although, you know, it's an argument from silence, so you have to sort of take that into account, it could just be a chance that we don't have material relating to it, is that this was a particular point of contention, or that there was friction at this sort of time of year. And in fact, we sometimes have the opposite, which is that we can see quite clearly that Jews, Christians and Muslims were cognizant of each other's festivals and were doing the polite thing, you know, when addressing each other, of mentioning the festival and celebrating, you know, the Muslim festival or the Christian festival, celebrating the fact that it was going on. And so there was a mutual understanding of holy days, and a feeling that, you know, although the details of the religions varied, their practices, celebrating certain holy days of the year, pilgrimages, that kind of thing, were basically held in common, and that people should, you know, politely respect each other's practices in that way. Now, the next document that I wanted to talk about is an example of where this is not really happening. And it is noticeable, remarkable, that it doesn't come from Egypt. It was found in the Cairo Geniza. So the piece of paper on which it's written was retrieved from that storeroom in the Ben Ezra synagogue by Solomon Schechter. But the original letter, which the paper contains, was not written in Egypt. That's quite clear when you look at it, because it's a leaf from a book, and letters aren't written on pages of books. Letters are written on individual pieces of rag paper. You write one side, you turn the paper end to end upside down, and then you write the second side and finish your letter on the back. And so what you always see in a letter is that the back is written upside down in relation to the front. People don't, in the Middle Ages in Egypt, they turn letters top to bottom, not side to side. That only happens later and in Europe and so on. Whereas this is written the same direction, both sides of the page, and it's clearly a page that has come out of a book. We don't have the rest of the book. We have maybe a few more pages of it. And what it appears to be is a record of diplomatic correspondence, or perhaps a record of belles lettres, poems, and fine writings of particular Jewish personages from Spain. And it's a letter, therefore, that has been chosen as a kind of model, either for historical interest or because of the rhetorical style in which it's written, as a model of, you know, fine Hebrew diplomatic writing. It's been copied and, you know, included in a book alongside other such models that people might want to either read for, you know, their entertainment, or for, you know, enriching their knowledge, or to use as a model for their own letter writing, particularly if they're aiming to write, you know, at a high standard to important people in the Jewish world. So it's a letter written in Hebrew in the very highest kind of register of Hebrew. It's extremely difficult to read. You have to search for very rare vocabulary that they've used from the Bible. And 90% of the letter is praises and blessings on the recipient. Now, this is quite common. People are polite in the Middle East. They were as polite in the Middle Ages as they still are today in large parts of the Middle East. It's a nature of the culture. And when you write a letter in the medieval Mediterranean area, you write it extremely politely. If you're not polite in your letter, then your request will be refused. This is the nature of correspondence in this period. Now, in fact, this letter, you know, was not written in the Eastern Mediterranean, but it appears that it was written in southern France, from Provence, which is something that is not well represented in the Geniza, because, of course, this for most of the time of the Geniza, this is a Christian land. It is, although it shares cultural links with Spain, with the Iberian Peninsula, and at times there were Arabic-speaking Jews living in Provence, for instance, and they had close diplomatic relations with the Umayyad regime in Al-Andalus, in the Iberian Peninsula. It was nevertheless a Christian land. Provence was part of Occitania. You know, it was often an independent kind of county or duchy. And it perhaps played itself politically between different Christian powers, and it certainly, you know, had relations and made approaches to the Muslim rulers in Spain. But nevertheless, it was a Christian land, and so it did not really have strong diplomatic relations with Egypt. And you wouldn't expect a huge amount of material to end up from there in the Cairo Geniza. But nevertheless, Jews in southern France were in communication with their co-religionists in the rest of the in the Muslim world around them, and particularly with the most important community in Egypt. And so we shouldn't be surprised that we do have a few remnants of this. And this letter in particular is interesting, one, as a model of how to write a very, very polite letter, but also because it tells us about something that we know only from Christian sources, but we did not have any Jewish record of before. And yet, if we take this letter, which we can't take as a primary source because it's not the original letter, it's a copy, but it's a medieval copy. The original letter was probably written in the 10th century. This is a medieval copy made probably in the 11th century. So it's, you know, there's certain corruptions in the language. Not all the details have survived the process of copying, but nevertheless, we you know, can treat this as a more reliable than, say, a, you know, historical source from the 14th or 15th century. This is written probably within a century of the, this is copied probably within a century of the original writing. And after lots of polite expressions and various extremely difficult to understand metaphors generally used to bless the recipient, it says that this letter, and in Hebrew it says, Mimeno kehilot faransa avadecha avak hadom rachlecha. So it says, from us, the communities of Faransa, which is France, your servants, the dust of your footstool. And this is a modest expression. It's found in Psalms, in Lamentations, in Isaiah. Medieval Jews do not write anything that doesn't have strong biblical connections. It's the nature of the Hebrew language that the highest model of Hebrew is the Hebrew Bible. And so they will always draw upon it for high register of writing. And we don't know who the recipient of the letter was. We know it comes from France, but we don't know who the recipient was. But because of some of the expressions in the letter, because of the time at which we believed it was written and the nature of the relationship between the communities of France and Spain at this time, we think it was addressed to Chastai ben Isaac ibn Shaprut. Now, he was a Jew who lived in Cordoba for most of his life. And he rose very high in the Umayyad administration of Al-Andalus. He became an advisor, almost a vizier, to the caliph in Cordoba, Abdulrahman III, and to his son. And when Chastai was in this high position of authority in Spain, he oversaw a period of great brilliance in Jewish letters and in Jewish high culture. When we talk about the Golden Age of Spain, which you may have heard of, often that sort of becomes morphed into an idea of a golden age of social and political life between Jews, Christians, and Muslims in Spain. And while there are some elements of it, it was not all, you know, sweetness and light. There was still a definite hierarchy, in the sense that the Muslim rulers of Spain were at the top and the minorities, the dhimmi, were down below. But looking at it from a cultural, artistic and literary perspective, it was undoubtedly one of the high points of medieval Jewish culture. And to talk of a golden age in that respect is absolutely right. And Chastai really was one of the leading figures of this movement, a celebration of Hebrew poetry, which drew upon the Arabic culture, the Arabic poetic culture around them, and created new forms of Hebrew poetry, and generally produced great writings that are today still read in the synagogue liturgy and still enjoyed as the highest models of medieval Hebrew writing. Now, the reason that the letter is sent to Chastai is because of his position of importance with the Umayyads. And what it seems is that they would like him, or rather they have been invited, well, clear from the letter, to give him a problem that he can solve so that he can, for instance, take it to the Umayyad rulers and attempt to deal with a problem that the Jewish communities are suffering in France. And they say in the letter that the community of Toulouse, which they called Toulouse, because in French at this period they still pronounce the final vowel, there is a difficult situation around the Christian season of light, the Festival of Light. Festival of Light relates to the lighting of candles, so that means Easter, when the cathedral in Toulouse is filled with candles. And it seems that the Count of Toulouse, all the Counts of Toulouse seem to be called Raymond, and he had instituted, or one of his predecessors had instituted, a policy whereby at Easter each year a high-ranking member of the Jewish community of Toulouse had to come to the cathedral and he had to make his way down the aisle and present to the Count 30 pounds of wax, so 30 pounds of candles, to be used in the Easter celebration. Now, there is obviously a symbolic meaning to 30. This is the 30 pieces of silver that Judas received. This is a symbolic punishment on the Jewish community of Toulouse, a payment of guilt for the killing of Jesus. Now, as a symbolic punishment, it's, you know, bad enough. It's a reminder that the Jews are second class. It's a reminder that in Christian theology, they are responsible for the death of the Messiah. But in practice, the procedure, this ceremony is much worse. And that is why the community is writing to Chastai to get the problem solved. Because after the Jewish elder has made his way down the aisle and quite likely that he had to crawl, for instance, before presenting the Count of Toulouse with 30 pounds of wax, he then received Petza Achat al Zavaro, which translates as a wounding blow on his neck. And we know about this because from Christian sources, from the chronicles of the Counts of Toulouse, we know that, strangely, the Counts of Toulouse practiced some form of Provençal karate, and that he, in accepting the wax from the member of the Jewish community, would then chop him or punch him on the neck, and that there are records that this caused serious injury and even killed members of the Jewish community over time. And so the letter is written in an attempt to use the Jewish relationship that they have through Chastai ibn Shaprut at the Umayyad court to put pressure on the independent but Christian Counts of Toulouse to stop mistreating the Jewish community of Provence. It's quite incredible, really, that this kind of relationship exists between the three religions. But from the tone of the letter, they have every confidence that Chastai will be able to sort this out. And indeed, from what we know of Chastai's record, he did often act as an intermediary between the Islamic world and the Christian world, negotiating at a very high level. And so it is quite likely that he was able to do something about this, although we don't have any further information from Jewish sources as to what happened. We just have this single letter. Now, the letter, I mean, it's a really great example of the high rhetoric. I mean, it actually ends, whenever you ask somebody a favour, not only do you have to flatter them before you get to the favour, but after the favour, you have to remind them that you've flattered them. And so it closes with, but it's only because of our great love for our Lord and our confidence in his great humility that we've therefore written only a hint of the fraction of the ways of our master and our teacher, the Prince of Israel, meaning Chastai himself. Let us give an example to illustrate this. It's like doing honour to a king who possesses 1,000,000 gold coins with the gift of 2 silver coins. But we were afraid to multiply words before the honour of our delight, the beauty of our perfection, the joy of our glory, the breath of our nostrils. All of these terms relating to Chastai. Okay. So I think we'll have another piece of music now.
Yes, we can do that. Thank you very much. It was a very interesting piece of slightly chilling history. And we'll listen now to the song Servant Song, Brother, Sister, Let Me Serve You by the Northumbria Community.
Sister, let me serve you. Let me be as Christ to you. Pray that I may have the grace to let you be my servant.
That was the Servant Song by the Northumbria Community. And you're rejoining us for the second, was it the third half of our programme, That's Just Life, with Dr. Ben Outhwaite. And he's now going to talk to us about how the boundaries of religion were surprisingly fluid. And we'll hear a little bit about a conversion story. Over to you, Ben.
Thanks very much, Sarah. So yeah, that was Servant, was it called Servant Song? Yes. The reason we played that is because the next document is about, was written by a man called Obadiah, in Hebrew, Ovadiah, which the root is from the root Eved Avad, which means servant, and the ayah at the end, Yah, is the name of God. So servant of God is the name Obadiah. Now, Obadiah is found very commonly in the Middle Ages as a name that converts to Judaism take. And we find in the Geniza that even though, you know, Jews are a minority in Egypt, they're definitely and officially, legally, socially, economically second-class citizens, nevertheless, there are still people converting to Judaism in this period. Obviously, there are people converting out of Judaism as well. If you want to go very high in the Islamic administration, you will hit a glass ceiling at a certain point that only Muslims really can get past. And so we do find that some Jews convert to Islam just so they can become the wazir, the vizier to the caliph and things like that. And that, you know, is perfectly understandable. And that is the reason why, of course, Egypt switches over the centuries from becoming a majority Christian country to a majority Muslim country as more and more people convert. But to see that people are actually converting into the minority religions is probably unexpected, given that they would be, you know, converting away from a certain social status into almost, you know, inevitably a lesser one. Now, in Egypt, it was very difficult for a Muslim to convert to Judaism or Christianity. And in fact, that, you know, that would be a death sentence, really. You cannot do it. And where we do have cases of conversion to Judaism, it's either not clear what the original religion was, or they are Christians converting. And we have a few cases of Christians converting. And the one I want to talk about today is particularly unique because, rather like the previous letter, it's actually someone who didn't begin their career in Egypt at all, but came from a Christian land altogether. So in fact, they chose in a majority Christian land, in a Christian ruled land, in fact, this is southern Italy, to adopt Judaism. Again, a potentially dangerous thing to do. They had to flee, in fact, and they settled in the Islamic world, where people didn't worry too much about, you know, where he had come from and so on. But it's still a surprising thing to encounter. And what's particularly interesting about this is that we really find out about him, firstly, from a manuscript which has the what we call the shelf mark, TSK 5.41. It's a manuscript of musical notation. If you look at it, it's a musical stave with notes written on it. The notes are not quite like modern musical notes. They're more like the kind of notes that you'd see in a musical manuscript of plain chant or Gregorian chant from the Middle Ages. They're what we call neumes, which are the kind of it's like one part of the note, the dot, without all the sort of tails and things on it. And it is the early form of musical notation. What we have is the stave with this musical notation, and under it we have some lyrics written in Hebrew. The handwriting is 11th or 12th century. It's written on Eastern paper, so it's written on rag paper that's produced in Egypt or in Palestine or Syria or one of these lands. And the hand is a very good, practiced Hebrew hand. It looks like the work of an average Jewish scribe, you know, someone who writes professionally for a living. However, the handwriting is recognizable, and we have a page from a prayer book which says that this prayer book was written in my hand by Ovadiah HaGer. Now, Obadiah HaGer, Ger means proselyte, someone who has converted to Judaism. So we can recognize the same handwriting between this prayer book and this piece of musical notation. So we know that the man who wrote the musical notation, his name was Obadiah, and he was a convert to Judaism. And that explains why we have musical notation, because Jews in the Middle Ages do not use Western musical notation. This form of musical notation, these what we would call Lombardic neumes written coming from Lombardy in Italy, was only really invented in the 10th century. And here we have it in the 11th or 12th century already being used in a Jewish manuscript from the Islamic world. This is utterly unexpected. And Jews don't adopt Western musical notation for centuries anyway, because they have their own way of noting the rhythm and tones of a liturgical reading. That already exists in the notation that's used on the Bible and that then comes to be used for prayer books and so on. So what is going on here? Well, what it seems is that Obadiah, in converting from Christianity to Judaism, decided to either write his own poetry, which were essentially hymns, to be recited in the synagogue. And in order to record the tune, he used the notation system, which was cutting edge and which he had learned in Italy. Or he enjoyed listening to the hymns, to the piyutim, which comes from the same root as English poetry. He enjoyed listening to the sung poetry in the synagogue, and he wanted to record it by writing it down using the notation system. It's not clear whether this work is original, whether he's heard it. But what we have in this leaf is we have as close as you'll get to an actual recording of how people were reading, reciting, singing Hebrew in the Middle Ages in a synagogue in the 11th or 12th century. Now, the poem itself is not particularly exciting. It's pieces of its various verses of the Bible. It begins with Baruch HaGever, Asher Yivtach Ba'Adonai VeHaya Adonai Mivtacho, which is from Jeremiah 17:7. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is the Lord alone. However, the fact it's given these musical neumes makes it quite unique and important and special. And what is even more surprising is that we not only know the name of the man who wrote this, Obadiah Hager, but because we know his handwriting, elsewhere in the Geniza collection, we find scattered fragments of his autobiography, and they fill in many of the gaps as to how this happened. Because not only did Obadiah come from Italy, he was actually a monk or a priest who had a revelation and had heard about a bishop from Bari in Italy converting to Judaism in a previous decade. He decided to follow in his footsteps. He converted to Judaism. He had to flee Italy and he settled in Baghdad. But in Baghdad, he learned how to read and write Hebrew, evidently very well because he writes a beautiful Hebrew. And he traveled through the Islamic world, Syria, Palestine, and eventually settled in Egypt, or most likely settled in Egypt, because there he wrote his autobiography, and we can collect scattered bits of it in the Geniza. And that fills in the gaps of his story. We can see that he, you know, adopted the Torah of Moses as a matter of faith. He came, it's not entirely clear what the revelation was. And you can always be cynical and question whether perhaps there was a political motive or perhaps his, you know, ambitions in the church were thwarted. But that seems slightly less likely, because to convert to Judaism is a seriously difficult step to take in Christian Norman Italy. I mean, he had to flee for his life, no doubt. And then ending up in an Islamic land where, as a Jew now, he is subject to the quite harsh taxes of the Islamic regime, and, you know, to the various suppressive laws that keep Jews as second-class citizens alongside Christians in the Islamic world. You know, having gone from being a member of the priesthood or a monastery in Italy to being a second-class citizen in Baghdad and Egypt is quite a step. And so you would have to say that it's not one you would necessarily make for frivolous purposes, and certainly not one you'd make for economic or social purposes. There must have been a deep-seated belief at the bottom of it. I think Sarah will have a piece of music.
Yes, we certainly can. Thank you very much for that interesting part on conversion. So we're going to listen to a song, Jerusalem, by Master KG. It's a nice upbeat tune. We'll be right back.
Thanks very much, Sarah. Yeah, so I mean, it would be remiss of me not to mention the Crusades. They are the sort of prime example of what can happen when interfaith relations spill out into open war, and they are a pivotal moment in the history of the Middle East that, you know, still reverberates today. The term crusader is still branded about, for instance. And you would expect them to leave a mark in the Cairo Geniza collection too, because much of the material, you know, comes from Jerusalem, comes from Palestine. There are many Jewish communities in Palestine and Jerusalem, in all the towns of Palestine and Syria, who recognized the authorities, the rulership of the empire in Egypt. And consequently, there's lots of communications between the Jewish communities of Palestine, even all the way up into Syria and to places like Damascus, with the authorities in Egypt, in Cairo. And so we have a lot of those documents that, you know, began their days in places like Hebron, Tveria, Tiberias, Caesarea, Jerusalem, all the sorts of towns of Israel, Haifa. And they show the very close links between the Jewish communities of Palestine and those of Egypt. Now, there was quite a different character to them because Palestine was a borderland. It was not always a safe place to live. The Fatimids conquered it after they conquered Egypt. So in the 11th century, for most of the 11th century, it was a Fatimid land. But even so, there were constant wars because there had been various Bedouin tribes had emerged from Arabia following the Islamic conquests, and some of them had settled in Palestine. And sometimes they chose not to recognize the suzerainty of the Fatimid rulers, and they rebelled against them. Sometimes they allied themselves with the Byzantine Empire to fight against other Muslims, or other times they just raided rapaciously through the land. And so Palestine was a very difficult and dangerous place to live, and Jerusalem, particularly poor town. It wasn't at this time even the capital of Palestine. When the Muslims had invaded Palestine, they created a new capital at Ramla, and that was the administrative capital of Ash-Sham, the Palestine and Syria. Jerusalem was a symbolic, a holy city, but it wasn't necessarily an easy or a safe place to live in this time. Now, of course, in 1099, the Crusaders of the First Crusade got there and captured it on their first attempt, and Jerusalem fell from Muslim hands into Christian hands. Now, they lost it again to Saladin and never really regained it. But in terms of a symbolic gesture of Christianity reasserting itself in the Holy Land, this was the ultimate prize, the capture of Jerusalem. And it reverberates through the Geniza. Although, again, what we possibly notice more than anything else is the silence that we get following the events of 1099. So in talking about all of these communities in Tiberias, Ramla, Haifa, Hebron, many of those go quiet in this period. And we no longer have the succession of letters, the correspondence, the legal documents, the evidence of people traveling backwards and forwards between Egypt and Palestine on business or on pilgrimage, the pilgrims going to Jerusalem to pray at the synagogue that was dug under the temple, under the Western Wall, and things like that. All of that comes to an end, quite sudden end. But it's not solely the Crusades that caused this, because the 11th century generally is a difficult and dangerous time. There are several major earthquakes that devastate Palestine. The city of Ramla falls down about twice. The Temple Mount is struck by an earthquake that causes the Dome of the Rock to partially collapse. The Western Wall partially collapses, with the synagogue dug under the wall, known as the Cave Synagogue, falls down and has to be rebuilt by the Jewish community. Tiberias is devastated. There are tsunami that affect the coastal towns with the earthquakes. And following on the heels of all this destruction, the Turkic Seljuks invade from the north, having conquered the Abbasid realm in Baghdad, set up their own caliph there. They then cross down into Syria and they capture Jerusalem from the Fatimids. And they are difficult and dangerous enemies. They are Sunni Muslim, but they represent a wide variety of peoples and beliefs. And they are regarded, although they are in and of themselves a high civilized culture that produces great, you know, works of architecture and so on across the lands that they conquer, but they're regarded by the Fatimids as barbarians who need to be stopped. And wars are fought against them. They're prevented from capturing Egypt. But it isn't until 1098 that the Fatimids can capture back Jerusalem from them. And in the period that the Seljuks ruled Jerusalem, the Jewish community ebbs away. It no longer has the diplomatic links with Egypt because one of them is ruled by Seljuks, the other by Fatimids. And we hear less and less from Jerusalem. Then it's recaptured in 1098 by the Fatimids. And what we get is the Fatimids barely have time to settle their feet under the table again in Jerusalem, then the Crusaders arrive. And this is marked in one particular manuscript, which I will have to discuss very quickly because I've gone on a bit, where we have evidence of Jews having to save not just their co-religionists, Jewish brothers and sisters, from being captured by the Crusaders. They have to ransom them back, but also their books. We have this great letter, which is written by the elders of Ashkelon. Ashkelon in the land of Israel, in Palestine, was not captured by the Crusaders at first. And so when the Crusaders captured Jerusalem, they traveled to Ashkelon and they sold back to the Jewish community of Ashkelon members of the Jewish community of Jerusalem and other cities of Palestine that they'd captured. And this letter describes how the Jewish community impoverishes itself by buying back captives, including children and women and so on, that have been captured by the Crusaders. And they have to do this because they want to prevent them, one, suffering any further, but also prevent them converting to Christianity, which would be a great sin for them. But in the course of this letter, what's clear as well is that they're spending a huge amount of money to buy books back from the Crusaders, because they actually say in the letter that they spend 500 dinars, so 500 gold coins, for the ransom of the individuals, but then they spend hundreds of more dinars to buy back 230 volumes of the Bible, books of the Bible, 100 other codices, books of some kind, and 8 Torah scrolls. Now, this shows two things. One is how important books are to Judaism, which is why we have the Kyrogenesa, but also that the Crusaders were not solely going in, killing, destroying, as some of the chronicles suggest, but in fact, they were quite carefully taking prisoners and they were picking up books from the places that they captured and they were selling them back to the Jewish community. And in many ways, that is why we now have such a rich assortment of material from Palestine in the collection, thanks in part to refugees fleeing the inexorable wars of the 11th century and bringing their books with them, but also the Crusaders having brought them to the borders of Egypt and delivering them at a price, of course. Okay, Sarah, I think.
Yeah, hi. You ready for your final piece of music?
Yes.
Actually, looking at the time, it's coming up to 11 o'clock. I think we might even be out of time for a final piece of music. So I will just instead say many thanks for coming into the studio this morning and for your very interesting and engaging talk on this amazing collection of manuscripts. It's much appreciated. And for those who maybe haven't heard much about the Geniza collections, if you missed previous episodes about this topic, you can catch up on podcast platforms from Spotify and Apple and many others. You can listen to Ben's first episode where he went into a lot of the background and history of the collection, which he curates and studies. So once more, thank you very much. Thanks again. And we'll hopefully hear more about the Geniza collection at some point in the future, but maybe for one of the other researchers, who knows?
You've been listening to one of Radio Maria's podcasts. If you enjoyed this, please consider supporting us with a once-off or monthly donation. To do so, visit www.radiomariaengland.uk or call 0300 302 1251 during office hours.